CBSI in the World, I'm John Batchelor with Judy Dempsey, the editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe. She's in Berlin, and Judy asks her colleagues frequently very hard questions that don't have single answers. And the question of these last days is a story that dominated the headlines at the turn of the century and through the worst of the conflict of the Israeli-Palestinian, Israeli-Hamas, Israeli-Hezbollah, Iran-Israel conflict of the early part of the century. But now with the war in Europe, it is not primary, but it's still there. The question, have the Europeans any influence in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Judy, I tell a story. My first trip into the conflict zone was in 2003, and I went to Bethlehem, thanks to the IDF, and into a building for a briefing. There was a siege going on at the time. An area of the city had been cordoned off, and the Israeli army was besieging Palestinian attackers. And I was struck by the fact that the building itself, it was a community center, was the product of the generosity, I believe, the Queen of Norway. I might have been the Queen of Sweden. I don't remember exactly. And I was struck by the generosity that was displayed in the building. I learned that the European Union then and now continue to be the largest donors into the Palestinians, as well as the NGOs that participate in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict of many decades. However, your question and the many answers I read introduces the possibility that Europe no longer feels it has a strong voice or a voice at all. Is that a general opinion that you received from your colleagues before we get to specifics?
It is a general feeling that I get from these experts and colleagues, but I think it's quite disingenuous. The Europeans do have leverage, but they don't use it. They don't use it in terms of the amount of huge financial assistance to give to the Palestinian Authority. But this is despite the huge corruption exercised by the Palestinian Authority. They don't do enough to support the really independent civil society and calls for democracy by the younger generation in Palestine. And so, on the other hand, they don't challenge Israel, particularly Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, for what he's doing now to the judiciary. Let's leave alone the illegal settlements. So the EU is the biggest donor. It doesn't use this leverage. And it has a huge cooperation agreements with Israel for scientific, trade, economic, you name it. But they don't use that leverage either. So essentially, they've been marginalized through their own fault, actually. And they have handed it over to the United States, which actually isn't very active any longer in trying to mediate in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
One of your colleagues, Aaron David Miller of Carnegie. I know Aaron David Miller. He's been on my show many times over decades. Used a metaphor that I thought was helpful because it's also promising, that the situation is in a cul-de-sac. In other words, you haven't lost power. You've dipped on the road ahead. Is that a fair image of what we have here, that there's so many overwhelming issues that this is just a bad patch, not the end?
Well, I think this cul-de-sac description, and it's right in some ways. It was not very helpful. And Aaron David Miller was actually very much involved in the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations when I was based in Jerusalem between 1996 and 2001. But they didn't make much headway, actually. So having a cul-de-sac, on the one hand, without explaining how to get out of it, is the dilemma or the big problem now the United States is facing. And they have to decide that if they're going to use its special relations with Israel, but also its dwindling relations with the other Middle East countries who have forged now diplomatic ties with Israel, if they're going to try to break this impasse. And as Aaron Miller says, he doesn't see it happening. A cul-de-sac actually means that you come up against a one-way street or a brick wall, and who's going to get you out of this one-way street?
I learn a German word that is a wonderful German word. You'll have to help me with it. Weltpolitik Fähigkeit.
Yes.
What is that translation into
a full meaning, sense? Meaning the ability to be a global policy player. Fähigkeit is the ability. It's a very cumbersome word, but it's a very nice German word. And Germany just doesn't have it, actually, as Nora Müller replied in the question that I had asked her.
Yes, and except Germany does. We see that in Ukraine. The U.S. was keen on Germany coming along. That was all the dialogue of these last weeks. In fact, from here, from this distance, Judy, Germany has replaced the United Kingdom in the eyes of official Washington as the player who must be with you in order for this to be a success, to stem the tide. So back to the question about the Middle East, it would seem that Germany has more power here than it is exercising. Is that a fair summary? Germany, not the EU, Germany.
No, I don't think it is a fair summary. I don't think Germany has that influence. It should have influence, but it won't exercise it because of its special relationship with Israel and the Holocaust. The whole legacy of the Holocaust shapes the entire German view of Israel, which is understandable. And so successive German governments, regardless of their political hue, has been totally committed to the state of Israel. Nobody's questioning the state of Israel. But Germany is very reluctant to use the leverage because of the kind of backlash it would receive from Israel, but because of the history. History plays an enormous role. However, it doesn't excuse the fact that Germany has to really break out of confirming a decades-long status quo and a consensus and a kind of tacit agreement between the Palestinian Authority and Israelis not to move ahead. It's very insidious, the relationship, actually. And Germany could have a role in actually influencing this if they really wanted to, especially on the Palestinian side.
So there, what we have here, one of your correspondents said that the EU has become a passive bystander. Is that fair?
Yes. It is fair, and the EU has become a passive bystander because they are divided. There are 27 member states which have different views of Israel, which have different connections with Israel, which have different views of the Palestinians, and also different views, really, is this a threat perception for Europe? Some of the southern members say, of course, this conflict is a total threat for the stability because it spills into the Middle East and then spills into southern Europe. The northern Europeans look at Russia, Ukraine, and the neighboring countries. So we have a real problem of the threat perception. Plus, we have historical divisions inside the European Union over how to deal with Israel and Palestine. It's a pity because Europe was leading the way 20 or 25 years ago when it came to dealing with the Palestinians and dealing with the whole terrorist issue and supporting the two-state solution. But they, as Aaron Miller said, they reached a cul-de-sac.
Judy Dempsey, Strategic Europe, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Berlin. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you can't measure it on your bathroom scale. Sorting out a mental health concern is not something to attempt on your own. You won't find a bipolar disorder by looking at a thermometer. Like many other health conditions, help for mental illness takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a stick-on bandage. So the sooner you seek treatment, the better. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, don't go it alone. Find out what to do. For 24-hour free and confidential information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support. That's samhsa.gov/support.